Next matter on our calendar is Red River Apartments LLC versus June Lacy. Each party will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that counsel identify themselves before they begin their presentation. Appellant may begin.
Michael Kemp for the appellant. Your Honor, may I proceed?
Yes.
May it please the court. Appellant June Lacy was a longtime resident of Respondent Red River Apartments. She had been a pageant queen. She was a frequent volunteer at the state fair and around places in Minnesota. But over the last several years of her life, she'd suffered from congestive heart failure, had suffered a stroke. And these conditions rendered her almost unable to speak, very difficult to see and hear. She was in a wheelchair and required assistance from her daughter, Joyce Lacy, for activities of daily living. In this case, what happened is because she had some issues that she needed help with, including needing oxygen, needing frequent care, she had requested through her daughter, Joyce Lacy, that Red River Apartments give her some accommodations. Now, importantly, the question we'll be getting to before the court is not whether she was entitled to those accommodations, but whether she'd requested them.
Can I ask you a big picture question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I look at your three arguments in your brief. One is that the district court erred in concluding that your client took no action to secure or enforce any right granted under law. The second argument is that the district court erred holding that facts before the termination but after the termination notice were not relevant. And the last one, that the court applied the wrong legal standard. The district court found, as a matter of fact, that the apartment managers were not motivated by retaliation, but were instead motivated by good faith, legitimate fire safety concern, and other concerns. If the district court's fact finding on that issue is affirmed, doesn't that defeat all three of your arguments?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
How could you secure an appeal if we affirm the district court's fact-finding, which I don't believe is challenged expressly in your brief?
The issue is what the burden was. And I would respectfully disagree with the court's point that the district court found that there was, in this case, that there was good faith on the part of the respondent. What the court said in that order at 12 was that defendant hadn't shown that the assertions made by respondent were illegitimate.
Well, however the district court got there, whether it's the right or wrong legal standard, what the court found as a matter of fact was plaintiff was not motivated by a retaliatory purpose. That was a finding based on the hearing the testimony, weighing the credibility. That was the district court's finding. Well, so why would it matter whether the district court put the burden on your client or on respondent if that is the fact finding?
Well, burdens do matter, but if I'm understanding the court's question, it's what did the district court find, and if the district court found that there was no retaliatory purpose in this, then what do we have left on appeal? I think that's the court's question.
It is.
And so let me set aside the burden issue and talk about those facts. If the court finds that there was a good faith reason put forward for the respondent's eviction of the tenant in this case, the court has still applied the wrong standard, because the standard is not that it has some reason. Under Parkin v. Fitzgerald, the Supreme Court has said their reasons must not only be legitimate, it must be wholly unmotivated by and unrelated to the claims by the tenant.
Why doesn't that finding subsume include that theory? Plaintiff was not motivated by a retaliatory purpose.
In this case, Your Honor, what the court said below was it laid forth a couple of reasons that the respondent could have had to evict the tenant, and said, again, I'd refer the court to the order at 12, that defendant's actions were wholly, the landlord's actions were wholly unmotivated by a retaliatory purpose. The court looked at it and said, no, defendant hasn't shown that these purposes set forward by the respondent were, in fact, non-retaliatory. It's a double burden shifting that is unwritten in the court's, 504B.285. It's a McDonnell-Douglas analysis is essentially what the district court is doing with that burden shifting, setting to one side the fact that the burden shifting shouldn't have been put that way at all. It shouldn't have been put back on the defendant in the first place. And that's the biggest issue with the court's findings. So we would respectfully disagree with the characterization that the court has made definitive findings below.
Well, here, let me use a different language, and I'm referring to page 13 of the court's decision. And you know that whether the findings are included in a statement under conclusions or fact findings, we look at the substance of the statement of the court. In this case, the court says, the court credits that notice to quit was given for this reason, meaning the non-retaliatory legitimate reason, and not as a penalty for any purported efforts on the part of defendant's daughter to secure or enforce legal rights for the defendant. So that statement seems to suggest that you've interpreted the district court's analysis differently from what the district court was actually doing. The district court credits that. In other words, credits the representation by the landlord, putting the burden on the landlord and accepting as true the landlord's representations. If I'm correctly construing the district court's analysis, doesn't that defeat also your legal position that the district court applied the wrong standard? If not, why not?
If the court had looked at the factual findings and said, we conclude that there are these reasons, one or several reasons, why the landlord, in fact, pursued this eviction. And if the court said, not only has respondent proved that, it's their burden, respondent has proved that, but also has proved that there are no other retaliatory provisions, that these issues that they used as a basis for their eviction were wholly unmotivated by and unrelated to the complained of action. If that were the case, yes, the appeal is over.
I guess I'm wondering why it would be unreasonable to interpret the sentence I read to you to say essentially what you've just said without using those exact words.
Because the court has said, and as we've cited in the brief, you have to look at the order as a whole, and the court made it clear that what it was looking for was for the tenant to prove that the provisions were non-retaliatory, or that they were retaliatory, excuse me. The district court made it clear in its order. It was putting the burden on the tenant to show that the landlord had a retaliatory purpose. And that's incorrect. And if the district court is viewing the facts in that light, what has the tenant proved instead of what has the landlord proved? What it does as a matter of law is it colors everything else.
You're focusing on the statement, I think, where the district court says, even if this were not the case, defendant has not explained why, that language?
Yes.
Now, the district court didn't say defendant has not proved but the defendant has not explained. In other words, it was looking to the rationale that even if this were the case, defendant has not explained why that motivation would be illegitimate. It looked to me like when the district court was undertaking that analysis, it wasn't putting the burden of proof, but explaining a legal concept that gave weight to evidence that was being offered by your client.
Well, we disagree, Your Honor, and the reason is, if you say defendant has not explained this in the context of a legal position where the defendant has no burden to explain it, it is on the respondent, it is on the landlord to explain it.
Well, the defendant the burden is on the landlord under Parkins to introduce evidence of some substantial nature to rebut the presumption. But as far as explaining goes, it seems you don't see a distinction between a court saying you haven't explained yourself and the court saying you didn't present evidence of such.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, our position is that's the exact same mistake that the district court made. It is not the landlord's burden to introduce evidence. That's what the district court found. Parkins says...
No, I understand that, but I'm talking about this sentence that where the district court uses the term explain, not defendant has not introduced evidence or produced enough quantity of evidence or quality of evidence. It was about explaining. It was about a legal debate that was going on between the parties about the nature of the evidence.
And yes, Your Honor.
And your position is that this is an inappropriate burden shifting of evidence as opposed to a discussion of what was being debated as a legal question.
That's correct. And if you read the opinion as a whole, you will get there because it is incorrect to say that the landlord only has to introduce evidence, which is what they did. They must prove that evidence, and they must prove that their reasons were substantial, non-retaliatory, and wholly unmotivated by these principles or what was being asked by the tenant.
Would you agree and that a fire safety concern is substantial?
Would I agree a fire safety concern is substantial? I would. I would agree with that in theory. And the question is, for instance, if the tenants are complaining about oxygen tanks, and in fact, the oxygen tanks are one of those things that Ms. Lacey needed to survive, the question isn't whether fire safety is a substantial non-retaliatory reason. It's, can you evict somebody because they need oxygen tanks?
I wasn't focusing on the... My question was more geared towards the accumulation, the unusual accumulation of garbage and other property.
Certainly, and we can address that.
Yes, that seemed to be the concern I thought the landlord was dealing with when you have a smoke detector that's apparently disabled in an apartment where it's sort of a tinderbox.
You have had an apartment where the tenant was given just hours of warning. I think it was over a day of warning. And as the record makes clear...
Why does it matter?
Because the record makes clear they were in the middle of a move at that time. There was a moving truck
downstairs. I thought the record made clear that after there was a request to enter the apartment and your client's daughter refusing admission, that then there was a moving van that was moving debris away.
No, Your Honor. What was on the record was they did go to the apartment. They asked to get in. Ms. Joyce Lacey didn't refuse them. She just said, can you come back a little later? There was also testimony from the respondent's own witnesses. There was a moving truck there. They had seen things being moved that day. They came back later and found the apartment was in substantially different condition. One particular day, the apartment was in a condition that all of our apartments might be if we're in the middle of moving.
You think so?
I think it might be.
When I looked at the photographs, it didn't look like it was in the middle of them. I mean, there was an accumulation of garbage, a mound of garbage, that it seemed to me that the district court can infer, that the landlord inferred, that this accumulation had been here and the fire hazard had been in existence for a long period of time, not that it just suddenly appeared. Would that be an unreasonable inference for the landlord to make?
Oh, certainly. If it saw that the condition when they came back, which the fire inspector did several times, and saw that it was not the condition of the property. And those, as we saw in issue two that we raised, were all before the termination. They weren't before the notice, they were before the termination. At the time that Ms. Lacey was evicted, it is clear that that issue that the court just raised was not an issue that the landlord had seen. In fact, the landlord saw the condition of the property was substantially different and substantially better, and the landlord's attempt to raise one particular visit in the middle of a move does not create a substantial reason for eviction.
Mr. Kemp, why is this appeal not moot?
The court is asking why, with the death of Ms. Lacey, that we can go forward at all.
I mean, it's an eviction case. The purpose of the action was to obtain possession of the premises.
It is, and that that part of it is moot. The court can't grant the estate back the property. What's left is the bond, the costs associated with that. And what I can say about
bond
that
is just security for something, but what is that something, and why is that a reason to maintain the case?
Your Honor, I see my time's run out. Can I briefly answer the question? What is at issue under 504B is all costs associated with a wrongful eviction, which can include the moving costs, can include the appeals costs. And honestly, if somebody who is in fragile health was wrongfully evicted and that can cause or contributed to her injuries or death, that is part of the damages associated with a wrongful eviction.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dan Moak from the Briggs & Morgan firm. Also with me is my colleague, Cyrus Malik. I will start where Judge Ross left off. Page 13 of the district court's decision says, quote, "The court credits that notice to quit was given for this reason and not as a penalty for any purported efforts on the part of defendant's daughter to secure or enforce legal rights for defendant." I believe that finding sums up the district court's decision. I believe Judge Ross cut to the chase on that. And given that finding of fact on appeal, this court can only disturb the district court's finding if this court were to find that that finding was clearly erroneous, which we don't believe on this record Your Honors can properly do.
Appellant's third argument, which has to do with the standard to be applied and burdens of proof. I mean, couldn't potentially that argument be a reason for reversal if the district court, before making that finding, you know, improperly used the wrong standard of the wrong evidentiary standard?
It could, Your Honor, but I don't believe the district court messed up the application of the law. I believe through pages 11 through 13 of the district court's decision, the court went through the non-retaliatory reasons that the landlord had come up with in combating the retaliation defense. And after the court went through that lengthy analysis, it concluded the court credits notice to quit was given for this reason, not as a penalty. That sentence, that statement, and that this order shows that the court analyzed it, found that my client, the landlord, put on significant evidence as to non-retaliatory reasons, and the court credited that. Again, on this record, I don't believe that Your Honors could find that that's a clearly erroneous finding. And both parties rely on the Parkin decision as sort of the seminal case in the area of retaliation. On page 832 of the Parkin decision, I think a key quote to keep in mind is a landlord must establish by a fair preponderance of the evidence a substantial non-retaliatory reason for the eviction arising at or within a reasonably short time before service of the notice to quit. I think the temporal statement by the Supreme Court in the Parkin decision is key, particularly in response to appellate's argument that, well, gee, after landlords served the notice, a moving truck pulled up, certain things were moved out, it was eventually going to be tidied up. That sort of argument and analysis is legally irrelevant under Parkin, which is binding. It's what did the landlord know before it served the notice? And I think
the issue of timing is not directly at issue in Parkin's.
Correct.
So that statement, at least that part of the district court's, of the Supreme Court's holding, might be taken as dictum.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the court in Parkin went through a bunch of cases from outside of Minnesota and said, this is the first time we get to struggle with the retaliation defense, and we're going to set out the applicable rules of law. And in fact,
but the temporal part of the rule of law was not at issue in Parkins.
As to whether we're talking about
before or after the notice to quit.
To the extent it was, Your Honor, because in Parkin, the landlord promised to make certain repairs. The landlord, of course, didn't make the repairs, so the tenant went to the authorities, reported the deficiencies of habitability and so on and so forth. An inspector came out, issued a report, and lo and behold, within days of the landlord receiving the deficiency notice, they gave the notice to quit. So in that sense, timing mattered, because I think the Parkin court drew a pretty straight line between, well, there was an inspection, then the report came out, and then lo and behold, the notice to quit happened. But I do think the fact that the apartment may have been tidied up a bit, which Your Honors can make your own conclusion based upon the photographs that we include in our addendum, that's legally irrelevant. What's relevant is what happened before we served the notice to quit. And I'll just walk through.
What might the district court and the landlord consider? There's sort of three moments, I suppose, that are potential. The argument by the appellant is that the district court had to consider conduct after the notice. One position might be the district court has to look at the condition of the apartment at the time of the notice, or shortly before, or is it plausible that the landlord and the district court can consider what the apartment looked like before the cleanup effort, before the move-out, which occurred shortly before, I say move-out, partial moving of material, immediately before the inspection?
I think the easiest answer is what occurred in this very case. What the landlord relied upon in analyzing whether or not they should provide the termination notice all occurred before they served the notice to quit. I think.
But I guess my question is your position that the landlord is allowed to draw inferences as to what the condition of the apartment was before the moving of material, but after the request for entry, the request that was denied or delayed?
Certainly, Your Honor. If what you're getting at is once the fire inspectors and the landlord's agents knocked on the door, finally the door was open because there were things leaned up against the door that couldn't even open. When you come into an apartment and view what the photographs show, I think it's reasonable for the landlord to draw an inference that this buildup of belongings and garbage did not occur in a day or two period, and certainly is not the
problem. Can the landlord infer that it was worse before the inspection?
I think under the circumstances, the landlord can, because appellant has argued that they hired a moving truck and had moved out substantial belongings before the inspection even occurred. And if that's true, there was even more debris and belongings in the apartment than the actual photographs depict. So what occurred before the notice to quit was served? I'm going to jog through these. There's six of them. One, the lease requires a maximum of only one resident, which would be mother in this case. The record reflects that daughter, due to the mother's health concerns, spent substantial time there, spending a lot of nights sleeping over. So that would be a violation of the lease, that there was more than one resident essentially living in the apartment. Two, unauthorized use of storage lockers. The mother paid for two storage lockers. The record confirmed that the daughter had moved her belongings into eight additional storage lockers, which obviously is unauthorized and you have to pay to use them. She didn't do that. Third, unauthorized storage of personal belongings in the garage. That's expressly prohibited under the lease. Record shows daughter stored things in the garage. Four, the daughter opened common area windows. We had a written policy on closing the windows because there had been theft issues. We wanted to keep our tenants safe. Daughter opened the windows claiming it was causing heat problems in the stairwell, when again the record confirms that both at the time mother and daughter were in wheelchairs and never used the stairs. Landlord investigated the issue, didn't find any merit that there was excessive heat. Fifth, the record shows daughter had refused prior apartment inspections, which gave rise to the fire inspection of 2018. Landlord couldn't wait any longer to inspect, which again, the lease gave us the right to inspect. Number six, the actual fire inspection report, and that's at our addendum, page 17 and following. The highlights of that report show, in addition to belongings and garbage piled up in the apartment, the smoke detector was hanging from its wiring. There were open junction boxes, open wire splices. Bathroom had substantial amount of dust. And then in terms of timing, the very next day is when the landlord gave the notice to quit. That shows a direct correlation between the seriousness of the fire hazards pointed out by the Fergus Falls Fire Department. And in the notice to quit, my client afforded the tenant 60 days to move out, which was double the actual time legally required. This was not some last minute, knee-jerk, made up retaliatory reason. This was a concerned landlord who has to look out for not only the interests of its investment in the building and the real estate, but also has other tenants to care for when you're talking about fire hazards and inability of people to get in and out of a building safely should something occur. That's all I have with respect to my argument on the merits of the appeal. Now, with respect to our motion to dismiss, we believe that this appeal should be dismissed for three reasons. I'll run through them quickly. First, the daughter has no standing because she's not mother's personal representative. This court, in Judge Cleary's order, required the appellant to get a personal representative to represent mother's estate. Instead, daughter went to Dakota County and got appointed as a trustee. That alone should be sufficient to dismiss the appeal. Under the wrongful death statute, 573.02 subdivision 2, that statute only allows a trustee to maintain an action which, quote, shall be for the exclusive benefit of the surviving spouse and next of kin. Setting aside the fact that retaliation is a defense, not a claim, even if it was a claim, appellant is seeking to pursue that claim on mother's behalf. Mother was wronged. She was retaliated against. Mother is not a surviving spouse or next of kin. It would be her estate. So it doesn't even fit within that rule. So your honors could look at 573.01, which says if you don't fit under 573.02, quote, all other causes of action by one against another, whether arising on contract or not, survive to the personal representatives of the former and against those of the latter. So the personal representative is required in this instance, and because there is no personal representative, the appeal should be dismissed. Secondly, the defense doesn't survive mother's death because there's no action for special damages. 57302 subdivision 2 says that the trustee can maintain an action for special damages. We've included mother's answer from the underlying eviction action. There is no counterclaim, which would have been compulsory under Rule 13. All there is an affirmative defense alleging retaliation. So there have been no special damages alleged in this case. That alone is fatal to the appeal. Finally, as Judge Johnson mentioned, the appeal's moot because no effective relief can be granted. Obviously, appellant conceded mother can't be restored to her possession of the apartment given her passing away during the pendency of the appeal. But the fact that there's a $5,500 bond in place doesn't change that analysis. As Judge Johnson correctly pointed out, that's simply a cost bond. And I re-looked this morning. Paragraph 9 of the district court's August 15th, 2018 bond order says, quote, a bond sufficient to cover $5,500 is reasonable and adequate to cover the appellate filing and moving costs for defendant. That's Exhibit A to our motion at page 6, paragraph 9. It's clear the court wasn't referring to damages, it referred to it as costs. It's a cost bond. There were no special damages pled, and we've cited in our brief Henderson versus Minnesota. It's Westlaw 671848 at page 3, where this very court said the overwhelming majority of federal and state courts have determined that the potential award of costs is not a sufficient reason to require a decision in an otherwise moot case. So
I think I could see a difference between the costs of the litigation or the costs that are automatically awarded under Chapter 548. But is there, within this case, a request for what are essentially damages, or you know, the out-of-pocket expenses that she incurred in moving to a different residence? I mean, I'm not sure what label is used, but that seems to be more in the nature of cost. Is that something that appellant is still seeking in the case?
There is not, Your Honor. And again, I think that goes back to special damages must be pled with specificity under Rule 9.07, and none of those were pled, and they should have been, as a minimum, a compulsory counterclaim under Rule 13.
Well, appellant's counsel made reference to them, I guess, but were they at issue in the trial? I mean, was there?
They were not, Your Honor. My understanding is the eviction action dealt with the recovery of possession. There was no counterclaim. My client did not make any claim for damages. Appellant did not seek damages as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Moe.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In rebuttal, Mr. Kim.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin where we ended by talking briefly about the motion to dismiss. The first question is whether the probate court properly appointed Joyce Lacy to pursue this appeal. The easy answer to that question is not before the court. That order has not been appealed. Respondent does not have standing to appeal. The probate court looked at this action and said Joyce Lacy is the appropriate person to pursue this action, and all this court cares about is that there is somebody with an interest in this litigation who has been appointed. So in this case, the probate court having decided that Ms. Lacy is the correct person to pursue this, she is the correct person to pursue this.
Can you skip to the third issue, mootness? I'm seeing this differently now. I mean, in the district court, did you or your client pursue what I'm, calling damages or compensation for out-of-pocket expenses?
No, that was not part of the claim for out-of-pocket expenses. None had been incurred at that point. Now, there were claims for attorney's fees, which were allowed under both the statute and the lease. Additionally, the 504B.371 requires that there be a bond if the defendant is evicted, as she was, that the plaintiff must put forth a bond to pay all costs and damages if the issue is reversed on appeal. In other words, there are costs that this court could award. If this court concludes that Ms. Lacey was wrongfully evicted, or it, put another way, at least that the district court erred, then what has happened is Ms. Lacey incurred several thousand dollars, not a huge amount, but some amount of money in moving costs, some amount of money in costs of appeal, at the very least.
So Mr. Moak said that that order, that the district court's order, was confined to cost, or that the purpose of the bond was cost.
Well,
are you saying it's broader than that?
The statute is certainly broader than that.
What about the order?
The order says $5,500 seems sufficient for the security for moving costs and fees, which is reasonable. It is. That's not to say that the plaintiff is not liable for any other costs and fees. And if this court determines that the district court erred, there were thousands of dollars incurred that would go to, in this case now, the next of kin.
Okay, so now if she had not moved out at the time of trial but only did so later, I guess that raises the question, when is the appropriate time for her to seek those out-of-pocket expenses? I mean, could she have done so to the district court in something like a post-trial motion, or?
No, because it's in the statute. The statute says, all right, while this is pending appeal, somebody has to have the keys to the property. If it's the defendant, she has to put up a bond. More often what happens in practice is the defendant is just required to continue to pay rent on time.
And so these expenses
are... If it's the plaintiff that gets the keys and the defendant is evicted, she's got to hire movers, she's got to find a new place to live, and during the pendency of the appeal, the statute makes it very clear that plaintiff must put up a bond to pay all costs and fees. In this case, a letter of security by the district court was deemed to be sufficient. We don't have a problem with that. That it was only $5,500 letter of security, we don't really take issue with that.
So if you were successful on the merits of the appeal, where would you seek that? From this court directly, or would you go back to the district court?
That would be back at the district court, Your Honor. I want to point out what was said by the respondent regarding Ms. Lacey's eviction. This is in the record. This was Exhibit 9, pages 3 and 5. Respondent said, Ms. Lacey should not be living alone based on our description of her condition. Said respondent was concerned that their building was not adequately equipped with nursing care for Ms. Lacey based on our description of her condition. Those were their statements of why they were concerned. And the district court, in looking at what the reason was for the eviction, had said, for instance, that plaintiff could be reasonably concerned, this is on page 11, about whether defendant would cooperate with future efforts to maintain safe conditions of the unit. Could is not enough. They needed to prove it, and they didn't. And for that reason, the district court erred. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp. Thank you both. The matter will be taken under advisement, and opinion will issue within 90 days.